This October, the most important week in bluegrass returns to Chattanooga, Tennessee. Be part of IBMA World of Bluegrass October 20th through the 24th for 5 unforgettable days of live music, networking, and family fun. Join thousands of bluegrass artists and fans for the IBMA Business Conference, IBMA Bluegrass Ramble, IBMA Bluegrass Music Awards, and IBMA Bluegrass Live Festival. Get your tickets, see the lineup, and start planning your week at worldofbluegrass.org. Thanks for listening to the BGS Podcast Network. If you're interested in diving deeper into the world of roots music, Americana, and beyond, be sure to explore more from The Bluegrass Situation. Visit thebluegrasssituation.com to browse the latest editorials. And don't forget to subscribe to our weekly newsletter for new releases, exclusive content, video sessions, and more delivered straight to your inbox. Sign up at thebluegrasssituation.com/newsletter.
I wanted recognition. I wanted people to know that I do this stuff, that I make these songs, and I wanted people to like the way it sounds, the music I make when I sing. And I eventually outgrew that. And I remember in this thing that happened, I was writing the memoir, Chinaberry Sidewalks, and when I put the last period at the end of the last revived manuscript, I closed the computer and I said, okay, if all I ever get from this is the satisfaction of knowing that I completed this work, knowing that I did it, that I completed it, is all the pay that I need.
We often define artists by their output, their records, books, movies, and the times they're on stage.
But the art is made in the quiet, the struggle, and the mundane, the hours that no one sees. I'm Michaela Ann.
And I'm Aaron Schaefer Hayes. This is The Other 22 Hours, an exploration of the creative life, lived in the in-between. This week is the fourth installment of our reissue series, where we go back through our archives and pick some of our favorite conversations from the past 3 years. In addition to these that we're featuring here, we also have 160 other conversations, all of which are inspiring in their own ways. So if you're on a long drive or mowing your lawn, please take a second to scroll back through our feed and find conversations with some of your favorite musicians and other artists that might inspire you. Additionally, you can head to our YouTube channel, where we have grouped every past conversation into playlists that are curated based on topic. So if you like this conversation, there are many more just like it.
And today's episode is featuring our conversation that we had very early on in this podcast life from May 31st, 2023, the legendary Rodney Crowell. Rodney Crowell is the definition of a legendary songwriter. He has multiple Grammys, 15 number one singles, and everyone from Emmylou Harris to Bob Seger, Waylon Jennings, and George Strait have recorded his songs. He is incredibly wise and generous. You can tell instantly just what a beautiful human he is. And we are so excited to reshare this wonderful conversation with Rodney Crowell. Good morning.
Good morning.
Thank you so much for being willing to talk with us and being here. How are you doing today?
I'm okay. Claudia and I had a one-day thing that was, she went first, just gutted, like as if a deflated blow-up doll, and then a headache. I said, oh, poor baby. And then yesterday afternoon, it hit me.
Oh, no.
And it's like, whoa, just gutted energy-wise, and then a headache through the night. Woke up this morning, I'm fine. Same thing as her.
Oh.
Like a 16-hour whatever. I'm good.
I've found that I am the caboose on the sickness train in our house, too. Our daughter gets it first, and then it gets to Michaela, and about a week after that, I get it kind of full force.
Yeah, well, now we get it from grandchildren. Yeah.
Yes, yeah. And you have so many now.
Yep, they're bringing home a lot of germs, and that's okay.
Yeah.
When I was raising them all, my immune system could take anything.
Yep.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, hopefully your grandkids are going to get you back there.
Hopefully. Well, they've tried. They're doing their job.
Because the premise of this podcast is to talk about how you keep yourself well, and you have an incredibly long career. How many years have you been in the music business?
51 years. Arrived in Nashville. I guess if you count the day I arrived in Nashville. It was 50 years ago last August.
Oh my gosh. And you're still writing new songs, making new records, still, would it be safe to say as inspired as the beginning, or has that waxed and waned?
More inspired.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, definitely more inspired. The lightning in the bottle thing that happens in one's 20s, because a lot of songs came to me in my 20s that were like, zamp. If I got that 20-something inspiration now, man, I could have written some songs. But but I managed to succeed back there in my 20s not knowing what I was doing. Now the inspiration comes from work. As I realized when I was a young man, inspiration went looking for me and found me. I guess the mystical part of creativity was like, oh, there's that guy down there. He can do this instinctively. Let's send him some inspiration. Now that same source finds me because it realizes how dedicated I am to the work. If I'm not on the road, this is my studio back here. You've been here, Michaela. I'll have a morning meditation and some coffee, and then I'm working because that's my blessing. I read once in the Essene Gospels, it said that the man, I always say, and or woman, who has found their work needs ask for no other blessing. And that's how I feel about it.
That's beautiful. So when you are back there working, is it always working on songs or is it working on writing prose as well? Because I know you write prose in addition to all these songs that you write.
Yes. The prose has been on hold for a while. I intended to get back onto book number 2, actually a lyric book that came out last fall, took up some prose writing time, but I have another memoir begun. In order to finish it, I would have to set aside 3 years. I haven't been willing to do that.
Yeah. Understandably.
Are there ever days when you show up to your work and feel challenged by it? Or is it something that's been a natural flow for you?
There are days when I'm challenged, for sure. I welcome those days. I'm confident that it'll reveal itself to me, what I'm searching for. There are times I'll sit 4 or 5 hours and don't get string 5 words together that really work for me. A lot of times I'll string 25 or 30 words together, none of which work for what I'm trying to get at. And that's okay. It's really a matter of coming back to work every day. When I do that, I'm successful at fulfilling my promise to myself, which is to own the blessing that I'm creative enough to make a living writing songs.
That's really comforting to hear. Because I feel like what can come with time is not getting scared when maybe it's not flowing as easily and trusting that it does come back and trusting in the process of when you keep showing up, it will return. We saw you a couple weeks ago and you mentioned you were going to do a vision quest. And in my experience, you seem to have a spiritual component to you and your approach to life and your creativity. Does that come into play ever of maybe some inner spiritual work that you do to help reconnect?
Yes. Writing for me is spiritual. It's a spiritual quest. Yes, I actively seek to develop my understanding of my inner spiritual life, none of which I would project on anybody else as the right way to do it. But early on, in my early 20s, I was introduced to a few things that sent me down the pathway to try to seek that source. I guess you'd call me a monotheist. There's a creator of all of this that's in my realm of understanding myself and the world. And I seek to make conscious contact with that source. Sometimes successfully, sometimes I'm a Luddite and I'm completely blocked on how to access my understanding of what that is. So it's an ongoing process, the same way as writing songs. They're tied together. Performing is a different thing. It's, as I say, and as you guys know, is that we don't get paid to play music. We get paid to travel. So far, I'm okay with that. This physical vessel that I'm doing it in, it doesn't like that traveling as much as it used to. But I want to go back to something that we were talking about just a few moments ago about the days when there's nothing there and being okay with it. There's another thing that happened with age for me that makes the work that I do now more satisfying for me. as a younger man, the things that I created, I wanted to bring me, of course, money, but I think even more than money, I never thought about money very much. It just seemed to come. But I wanted recognition. I wanted people to know that I do this stuff, that I make these songs, and I wanted people to like the way it sounds, the music I make when I sing. And I eventually outgrew that. It was in my 40s before I really outgrew that. And I remember in this thing that happened, I was writing the memoir, Chinaberry Sidewalks, and when I put the last period at the end of the last revived manuscript, I closed the computer and I said, okay, if all I ever get from this is the satisfaction of knowing that I completed this work, if nobody reads it, knowing that I did it, that I completed it, I completed the journey, is all the pay that I need. And the beauty of staying alive and doing it for a long time is I'm happy when I get feedback or when I get recognition. I'm a human being. But anymore, it's knowing that I did it, that I completed what I started. And to me, that's enough. Mm-hmm. It's, the rest of it seems to take care of itself. Sometimes money comes, sometimes it doesn't. But for the most part, nobody in my family has gone hungry and we all have roofs over our head. And it's been mainly because I've just been writing these songs.
I love that point of view. That's something that I'm slowly starting to learn for myself, is to shift my definition of success for myself from the reception and things that are outside of my control into measuring how close I am to my creative vision and how much I'm able to create, how much I'm able to finish and all that, and keep it within my circle of control. And I feel much more grounded and centered and inspired when I stay in that realm versus looking exclusively outwardly for the reception and judging my success on that.
Yeah, I understand. Time can be a great healer on that front. Mm-hmm. Practice living is what we do.
Yeah, absolutely.
I'm curious too, because our generation, we were into our music careers a few years when kind of social media and streaming was a thing before I started recording records. So also the way that reception is received, you've seen so many changes of now you put out music and you can see kind of instantaneously online, people might listen to it right away and comment, and you can get that feedback so quickly versus when, before, when you would put out a record and people would maybe get to hear it on the radio and then wait to get to go buy the record. And there was so much more time in between. It was so different because there were so many more steps to get to the songs and the records that you wanted. It was a different relationship to music in general. And I wonder, has that changed at all the way that you feel about putting music out because of the different way that it's changed how it's received?
Yes, things change, obviously. And technology was analog when I came. Tape machines were rolling. People were using razor blades to edit. Recording engineers were brave souls. They would take a razor blade to a 24-track piece of tape and edit it. So it was a slower process. And the satisfaction of whether something would sell or not, or how it was received, was delayed. So you had a little time to come to grips in your own way with what you had done. For example, I'd made records in the late 70s. Generally speaking, by 6 months after I've made a new album, I pretty much understand whether or not I succeeded in doing what I wanted to do. It takes a little time. And then basically I won't listen to anything that, again, for a long time, and then something will happen and I'll listen to an album and I go, it's better than I thought. But the fact that back in the day you had a little time to come to grips with what you had done, so that if it wasn't very well received, well, you already knew that was going to happen. And if it was well received and you agreed, there was a sense of success and completion. Now, I will say I'm no different than you are. When you were a kid, either of you, when we heard that music, we were, I think of those cartoon cats who smell catnip and they're floating off the ground and they're following the scent of the catnip. Well, we were following the music in the air. We left the ground floating. And it's always been that way, and it continues to be that way. And putting vinyl records on in a room, it was an analog ritual. And the music sounded different coming from those speakers on the floor in your hippie crash pad back in the 70s, and back when 4K on up in my hearing was a lot more user-friendly. I didn't need that top end. It was there. But I think I have a more intimate relationship with music as a listener now. The earbuds and listening music on my phone. There's hiking around where I live. I got an hour hike through the hills and around. And I always listen to music, always. Sometimes podcasts. But I listen to music, and it's a very intimate experience that the catnip that used to be floating across the room is now inside my head. I still like vinyl music at dinner time in the room, maybe cooking dinner. But listening to Kendrick Lamar with my headphones as I'm walking, I'm way up inside, how did this man get here? How does he sustain this creativity? He's blessed. And that's the intimate connection. And going back and listening to the Beach Boys or Take Your Pick, there's something about it that's more intimate to me now. And I think because I just said it really, that the catnip used to float through the room. Now it floats in my brain with those earbuds. Mm-hmm. And I like it. So I'm not entirely disappointed that technology and digital technology has brought music that close. Sometimes I long for the days of when we ran tape and recorded because the process was slower. We had to wait for a rewind. Mm-hmm. If you were overdubbing back in the day, you wait that 47 seconds of rewinding you spent thinking about what you're doing instead of just instantly you're back to the beginning if you're overdubbing.
I don't know if I've ever really thought about it. Just the patience, it's inevitably having time to sit and think and recenter yourself. Like, I'm in this place, this is what I'm doing, where overdubs can be rapid fire.
Yeah, they can. And I guess there's an upside to that too. But I think the extra hour of contemplation you get at the end of a day's worth of rewinding is probably a real positive step toward what you're trying to do creatively.
I really do think it does come down to the milliseconds that add up to an hour of the way we can be pulled out of things today. Like if you're in a recording session and people have your phones and you take a break, or if you're not the one recording that moment and you look at your phone versus if you didn't have that option, you were just sitting. All these kind of moments in this fast-paced life and a lot more distractions, I often find myself wondering, what idea could I have thought of if I hadn't been pulled out and checked my text messages or scrolled Instagram really fast? Or I wonder what my performance would have been like if my brain had been more centered in the moment and not looking at what notification I had on my phone type of thing, which is the evolution of our technology and civilization. But it's a lot to think about in today's time of making the choices to be more conscious with our creativity and therefore conscious with our choices of how we live and operate, which is something I feel like I'm not very good at, which is one of my motivators in this podcast, is hearing mm-hmm. how other people consciously live maybe outside of what would be natural or a habit because of the things they've learned that lead to a more fruitful, creative, content lifestyle.
Yeah, just a few minutes ago, we spoke and I said, I told you I'm about to go on a 7-day vision quest. I'd gotten to a place where I was kind of jumbled inside. I was a little confused about keeping appointments and writing things down, and it was just jumbled. And I missed a few cues, just things that I agreed to do and showed up someplace a week early, things mm-hmm. like that. Just out of step with myself and with time as we don't understand it. So for me to unplug everything, especially the phone, and to spend my days out of doors, walking, looking at the trees, talking to the trees, listening to the birds, breathing deeply, taking another walk, staying away from the phone, it reset my center to where the mixing up in my head, who's supposed to be where and when and all of that, cleared up. And I knew I needed to do it. So it's a tool for me that actually has proven to me now as I get older, I need to do it more often because mm-hmm. certain things happen with this physical body. The synapses in the brain and these little things that you realize that, oh, these things aren't working as well as they used to. Certainly my experience is carrying me along, but this physical existence, it needs help. And if we don't help it, it'll crap out on you pretty quickly as age catches up. So I have to be really conscious. If I want to get on stage and really deliver, I have to be conscious in the other parts of the day to feed myself physically, spiritually, mentally, to make sure that I have energy.
This is something that you've stepped more into as you've gotten older, or is this something that you also did as a younger person?
I did it as a younger person. My intention was 7 days of fasting. I used to fast 7 days in a breeze, really, and it's really restorative. And I got it from the Essene Gospels, in which there's a sentence in the Essene Gospels that says, for every day of prayer and fasting, you heal a year of your life. So back in my 50s, I was 4 or 5 years ahead in terms of healing years of my life. And then as time, it's not as easy. So I had to bail on 2.5 days was all I could get into the fast. But I realized that's okay. There was the other 5.5 days of sunshine and air was just as restorative for me. The fasting is really clears out the whole organism and resets the whole thing. And at times back in my 40s and 50s when I was doing that, I was like, I could not contain the amount of energy that I had after I did that.
And this is a total fast, just drinking water, or are you drinking
water, lemon, and cayenne pepper?
Oh, yeah.
Yep. We were 20 years old and we were in college in New York City. We were doing it and we met and talked about it.
Yeah, it's funny. I learned about it living in Asheville, North Carolina, and had friends that were doing it there. So I had done it, and this was the second or third time I was in the middle of doing it. And I had noticed Michaela, and I think she noticed me, and we were both on this fast.
Yeah, you became fast friends.
Very fast, yeah.
I want to also note the vision quest that you called it and recentering. When I saw you, you said, I'm going to go somewhere. And then after, a couple weeks later, when I talked to you, I asked you where you went, and you physically stayed in your backyard, and you have a lot of nature in your property. But it was just interesting to note that when you said, I'm going to go somewhere, you weren't like traveling hours away to some retreat to do this vision quest out in the desert or whatever. You stayed where you were in your home.
But I went somewhere.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I love that.
Yes, it's true. And traveling through stillness, you know, meditation, really getting into a deep meditative state, and then connecting with that higher form of myself that could be called God, or it could be, I don't know what you would call it, but it would take me out of all of the stagnant thought that had built up in my heart and my mind, and that was causing me to be grumpy. Yeah, it's like, Claudia is so patient with me, and she looks at me and rolls her eyes when I get grumpy. And I think she's learned about me that if she just rolls her eyes and minds her own business, I'll get the message and go straighten myself out. And to straighten myself out, sometimes I have to go somewhere, even if it's in the backyard.
I know you're getting ready to go on tour. Do you feel like you get rumbled up frantic energy when you're leading up to promoting a record and about to go on tour and you're going to be out in the world a lot? Is there a different energy that comes that you have to care for when preparing for that work versus the work of writing and being in your home studio and creating?
Yes. We've assembled a new band for this one. Some of the folks that I've been working with the last few years are still in, but we've reorganized the particular musical combination that we're going to be putting on the stage. So I don't like to do my songs based on if you just listen to the records. I much prefer to get an understanding of what we are as a collective musical entity, the drummer, the bass player, all of us. Who are we now? And how do we approach these songs of mine as who we are now, rather than what was happening when it was recorded? So that takes some work in the beginning, could easily just get some really good musicians, say, here, listen to the record, and we'll go play it like this. The satisfying thing for me is finding out how we all work together, whose personality, whose style, whose sensibilities bring certain things to the music, to find that combination and to get out, you know, early and 4 or 5 shows in and have it click in and where, now we're doing this unconsciously. We're all who we are doing this. Mm-hmm. I like that. That's a very satisfying process for me, and I always learn something from it. And I get a lot of confidence when everybody has blossomed into who they are in relation to the music, not who they are in relation to me. That helps me grow. And I look forward to that. And then once out on the road, I'm pretty healthy and happy out there. I don't go raid the refrigerator at night and eat some kind of sugar that makes me sleep crappy. Mm-hmm. Generally speaking, I have an orange or an apple or a banana in the hotel room, and that's about that. So therefore, I kind of get healthier out on the road in a way. It's still hard traveling, though, getting a body around it. But I do pretty well. And I'm looking forward to this tour. It should be fun. We got a really interesting group of musicians, and I dare say that we'll get pretty good.
I can imagine that really emphasizing everybody's uniqueness that they bring to the music makes playing some of your older songs pretty fun, seeing new light brought to them and new energy.
Yeah, it does. It's like, oh, I didn't know this song could do that. That's just by new personalities interpreting something that perhaps not how I would interpret it. Their interpretation can inform my own reinterpretation of something that I've made, that I've written. It's a very satisfying thing to have happen. And, you know, to be honest, I tell Jed Hughes or people I've worked with before, I say, look, Joe Robinson, I'd say, go out there to the edge of the stage and play that guitar. And if you get all the attention in the house, it doesn't make me look bad. It makes me look good. Go mm-hmm. do it. Go do mm-hmm. it. So anytime mm-hmm. the musicians I'm working with become focused because of their unique talent and who they are, it's like, I feel good about it. And it makes me take confidence from it, from like, yeah, this audience is loving this. It doesn't have to be all about me.
Yeah.
In fact, it's better when it's not all about me.
That's a reoccurring theme that comes up in a lot of these conversations mm-hmm. of people learning, I'm better, I'm healthier, I'm more centered when it's not all about me. And I'm in service of others and honoring others in life and on stage. And I think as an audience member, I remember I played a couple of shows with Marty Stewart, and I watched his show just transfixed because, one, he's incredible, but also every single person in his band is incredible. And mm-hmm. he showcases each of them and lets yeah. each of them shine. And it never made me think, oh, I'm more into the drummer now than Marty Stewart. It just made me love Marty Stewart more and want to go see more shows. So that's a really interesting note, because I think sometimes maybe a more immature mindset can think, oh, no, I have to somehow keep the focus to me.
Yeah, because who will I be if I lose the focus?
Yeah. Yeah.
To be part of something and to be in service of that something, when everybody is there and doing it, it just makes it better.
Hey, just a quick pause from this conversation. The Other 22 Hours is an independent production built entirely on the idea that these quiet, honest conversations matter. The best way to support our work is simply to share it. So if you can think of one person who would appreciate this show, please pass it along. And if you haven't yet, please follow our show on your listening platform of choice or subscribe to our channel on YouTube. It's a small action that makes a massive difference for us. Thanks for being here. Let's get back to our conversation.
You just said, who would I be if I lose the focus? Which brings a question for me. When you first came to Nashville, did you move here as an artist, or did you move here because of all the songs that were written here and you wanted to be a writer? We all know that your career has blossomed into being both. So just wondering what your initial intent was in coming here and maybe how you navigated what has become your career.
It's a long story, but I will make it as short as I can.
We're here for it.
Donovan Coward and I, who travels with me and mixes sound, we were a folk duo in East Texas at college. We met a guy and took us to Crowley, Louisiana, and we recorded an album of our woefully inadequate songs at the old J.D. Miller studio in Crowley, Louisiana. We went back to Houston and working in a steakhouse playing Simon and Garfunkel songs. Meanwhile, the producer went off to Nashville, unbeknownst to us, and called me a few months later and said, round up Donovan and get up here to Nashville. He said, I've signed you to a 10-year recording contract with Columbia Records, and you're going on the road for a year with Kenny Rogers in the First Edition. Get up here.
What?
Yeah, what? Well, I didn't have the wherewithal to say what at the time. I spent my last few dollars on a new guitar because I wasn't going to need it since I've just been signed to Columbia Records and Kenny Rogers, the First Edition tour. So off we go. Donovan and I get in the car and drive all night and arrive in Nashville in the wee hours and look around. There wasn't a welcoming party at 3 a.m. And so we slept somewhere in the car and showed up at Columbia Records the next day and said, well, we're here. Rodney and Donovan, we're here. And they go, who? Who? So the receptionist calls somebody, comes down, and they said, we're Rodney and Donovan. We're here. We're here to sign our contract. And it hadn't yet occurred to us, where's the producer? Well, then somebody else comes down a little higher up and comes down and says, look, we never heard of you. We don't know who you are. There's no record deal here for you. Oh, okay. Well, there must be some mistake here because we got the phone call. Well, I'm sorry, you know. So we walk out on the sidewalk and I was like, what? And there was a songwriter involved with this producer who, I don't remember how we got in touch, but he got in his car in Houston and drove to Nashville and found us somehow because we were sleeping out on the lake on the top of picnic tables and driving in and trying to figure out what our career was supposed to be. Obviously, there wasn't a tour to go out on. But the songwriter came and said, look, hey, you know, the producer sold your tapes and your publishing to this publishing house over on the corner over there, Surefire Music, owned by the Wilburn Brothers. And he said, and by the way, the tapes and the contracts are on top of a filing cabinet there. I don't know how he knew that. So we went at lunchtime and checked it out and said, huh, okay. The next day we went back. Donovan went in and charmed the receptionist, and I found the office, and there was our tapes and publishing contracts on top of a filing cabinet. And I just put it under my arm and walked out the door with it, and they're right in there in my storage in my home studio right now.
Wow.
That's how I got into the music business. You can't make that up.
Oh, no. My God. So you guys then just stayed?
I just stayed. I just said, well, okay. He went to Arizona for a while. We didn't hook back up until I moved to Los Angeles to work with Emmy Lou, but I stayed, and pretty soon after that, I met Guy Clark and Skinny Dennis and Richard Dobson and that whole crew, and suddenly I was surrounded by songwriters, and I went, I really want to stay here and figure out how these guys do this stuff.
Wow.
There's a lot of nuance to that story. That was the cool.
Yeah. I'm still taking all of that in. So after meeting Guy and Skinny Dennis and all of that, they turned you on to the idea of just being a songwriter, or in the sense of like having other people cut your songs.
Wasn't about that. Never has been about that for me. And it was, yep, a lot of people have recorded my songs and I'm grateful for it, but it was never about that. Through Guy, I met Towns Van Zandt and Mickey Newberry, and Mickey Newberry was... Think about Guy and Towns, that they had more of baritone voices, Billy Joe Shaver, Chris Gustafson. There's poets with that baritone sounding voice, the gravitas. Mm-hmm. And I was a little loss for how to be poetic with a natural Irish sounding tenor until Mickey Newberry came, and Guy put me on to Mickey Newberry, and Mickey had a beautiful tenor voice, but he was writing San Francisco Mabel Joy, and she even woke me up to say goodbye, and I was like, oh, you can write in that poetic style and have a tenor voice. So Newberry was the one that really helped me find my own voice and the language that I would eventually stumble onto, adopt, or cultivate. And it was never about writing songs for any other purpose other than to write the song the best that you could at any mm-hmm. given moment. I always felt lucky that that's what I stumbled onto. And probably I wouldn't have come to Nashville if I hadn't been hijacked by a lion producer. mm-hmm. So it worked perfectly. It landed me exactly where I needed to be doing what I'm doing today.
That goal of writing the song the best that it can be. Sounds like that's still the goal for you.
That's the goal,
still
yeah.
The vision across the board.
To me, there is no other goal. I always say, I have these songwriting camps where people come and I say, well, look, I can't teach you to write songs, but I can share my knowledge with you and I can try to encourage you. And I say, what I've learned is that if I'm patient enough, the song will eventually tell me what it wants to be. If I don't try to force my will on the song, make up something I think it ought to be, it'll happen. And with that mindset, I've spent 30 years writing songs. But see, I started Shame on the Moon in 1979. I'm still not finished with it. So that's 40-some years. I think I may have finished it a couple of years ago, but I'm not sure yet. And it went out there and lived its own life and was a big hit for Bob Seger. But that last verse was not a good, well-written last verse. And I talked to Bob about it. I said, man, I recorded it. I said, but that last verse is just not right. And he said, oh, I like that last verse. And someone who will remain nameless recorded it and found me one day and he said, well, I recorded your song, man. He said, I wish I could have been there with you to help you on that last verse. And I think he meant to dress me down a little bit, but I grabbed him and I hugged him and I said, oh, man, thank you. Finally, somebody agrees with me. He was taken aback. Yeah. It was true. That last verse was shite.
So you feel like you're still working on that verse?
Think I might have it. I'm not sure.
That's incredible.
So is this common practice for you to continue tinkering, I guess, for lack of a better word, massaging and adjusting, even after songs have been recorded and put out, you're still aiming to get closer to the core of what that song is?
On some of them, I'm still discovering the error of my early way on it. And I'm always happy when that happens. It gives me new life. Susanna Clarke told me this story that the museum in Spain, where most of those Picassos are, that a lady was there, like from Oklahoma, and there's a little guy down there dabbing paints on the Guernica, Picasso's super magic painting, and she was running for the watchman. You know, said, "Quick, there's somebody desecrating the Guernica," and the guy goes, "Oh, madam, that's Picasso. He works here." I don't think that's a true story.
But it's a nice message.
It is. It pretty much supports my theory about these songs will eventually tell me what they want to be.
When you are circling back on songs that are 40 years old, are you able to tap into that initial creative space that you were in while you're writing it? I would imagine that you're inevitably bringing a new point of view, new life experiences. So are you able to stay focused on just that third verse and chase what was still there? Or is it coming 4 years later and be like, this whole structure here needs to change?
In the case of Shame on the Moon, I worked on that last verse for years and years and years and years, even after it had already been out in the world and did its job. And then one day I said, God, I keep trying to write this last verse. Dang. And so I just rewrote all the verses, top to bottom, a whole new version, saving that chorus. The best thing about it was that chorus anyway. And when I did that, and then I recorded that on this record I made called Acoustic Classics. It was just acoustic versions of some of my more well-known songs. So I did that version of it. And when I heard that, I went, nah, it's still the last verse. I haven't improved anything on the early verses. So I took the best of the three new verses and created a last verse. And I didn't sing the song live because Bob Seger sang it so good. I mean, he sang it so well that it didn't matter if the last verse wasn't any good. Mm-hmm. All you could hear was that voice and that passion that that man was bringing. So I didn't perform the song live for 35 years or so because I said, that belongs to Bob Seger. But a couple of years ago, I started doing it again with a new third verse. And I feel confident when I do it. I'm still in the shadow of Bob Seger's brilliant performance of it. And Sometimes I feel self-conscious that I'm not able to deliver what he did, but I can deliver my own version of what it is. Mm-hmm. And I guess that's enough.
How do you know when it's done? Are there songs you have that you know are done, or is kind of everything always malleable?
There are more that are done than are undone, mm-hmm. not yet done. Guy Clark was so valuable in my formative years as a songwriter. And he was so generous. I'd go see him with a new song, and he'd say, okay, put the guitar down. Tell me the word. Look me square right in the eye and tell me the words to your song. And when I would, Guy had those intense eyes. When there was a bad verse or a bad couplet, a bad rhyme, soft rhyme, something wrong, something that didn't belong, I would naturally avert my eyes. That instilled something. I went, oh. And what he was teaching was that if you can't look me in the eye and tell me the words that you're going to sing, then they're not what you're looking for. So that sort of became part of my process. I guess I more or less know when I want to avert my own eyes from myself. This, I'm whistling past the graveyard here. This is not right. So that helps. That was a seed planted a long time ago that I still feed off of.
From listening to you talk, and I also follow your Facebook page, and you share a lot of little 3-paragraph stories of your life on your Facebook page. And you always seem so comfortable sharing not just your accomplishments or things that you feel good about, but also the things that you very honestly think of as not as good or seemingly a failure. You're very vulnerable. I'm always very drawn to people who show the hard stuff. I read your Wikipedia page, and it's like just so many accolades and high points and incredible successes, but I want to know all the in-betweens. And I feel like you are very, even just publicly, very generous with sharing, no, this was hard for me, or I struggled with this, or that wasn't good enough. And I read a post that you wrote. I was looking through your stuff last week, and you shared how you were in a low ebb of your creative life, and you made some records that you called pretty forgettable. There's a story of you recorded a record and you took it to a friend of yours who I'm forgetting his name, who's a sound engineer.
Richard Dodd.
Okay. You played him the record and he said, that was a really nice record, Rodney, but go home and put that on a shelf and go make a real record.
Those were his words, yeah.
And that could be crushing for a lot of people, but you went home and did that. And then am I correct that the record that you made was Diamonds and Dirt?
No, the record I made was The Houston Kid.
Oh, okay.
Which is, I think, a superior record to Diamonds and Dirt was a big hit, but Houston Kid was an artistic step forward for me. First of all, when Richard told me that, you know, and he's been apologetic for all these years for that, but he was right. And on the drive home, I mean, I left mad. But on the way home, I realized he's right. I was trying to make a record for what I thought people wanted, Diamonds and Dirt. It's like a big hit record, try to make that again. Diamonds and Dirt was, I wasn't trying to make a hit record when I made that record. I was just recording songs and trying to sing in tune. Not much more to it than that. But I realized he's right. So I did. I put it on the shelf. And it dissolved. but I made The Houston Kid, which started a really creative run for me that I think I've mostly maintained since then, the 20 years or so. It was a turning point because Richard was honest, mm-hmm. and he was right. And I tell him, I said, it was a blessing, man. Let it go. And he said, oh, no, I'm really sorry, man. And I spent a lot of my own money on that record. Later on, I made another one that I put on the shelf that didn't necessarily need to be put on the shelf. It's like I rediscovered it during COVID, found it on the shelf and listened to it. And I went, wow, this is good. So I was going to put it out until I got an opportunity to go record with Jeff Tweedy up in Chicago. And that's a record that's coming out for obvious mm-hmm. reasons. But, you know, I'm not always right.
Do you feel like the moments in your career where you've had really high reception, awards, accolades, success, has that ever affected your relationship to your creativity, like that expectation of trying to do it again or make something that will be received in the same way?
Yeah, especially the records that I thought were forgettable were post Diamonds and Dirt, when the record company gave me a lot of money. The exchange was, here's a lot of money, now go make records like you did on Diamonds and Dirt, which I wasn't able to do. Wasn't anybody's fault. I had a great producer to work with, but I was putting the cart before the horse, which is trying to create something that's already happened again, rather than what's happening now. So I learned a lot from that. And I also, you know, I had my 15 minutes of fame and I didn't handle it well. It felt to me like my sensibilities, my personality, first of all, I would not be able to work in a formulaic way, which is I'm going to do this because I'm really successful at it. I'm going to keep doing that. I think maybe part of the reason that I'm so, as you say, generous about my failures is because I fail probably more than I succeed in day-to-day work. I think, you know, it's probably 65-35. Mm-hmm. And I'm quite comfortable with my failures as long as I don't put them out there. Sometimes they're out there, you know. I was like, okay. I didn't like my voice until I was 50 years old. I just simply did not like it. I've certain friends and people have, why don't you like your voice? I liked your voice. Amy Lou, she always says, I love your voice. I love your voice when you were 25. And I said, yeah, okay. But I'd heard Aretha Franklin. I'd heard Ray Charles. Like, oh, come on. You know, it's like the bar is up. I was like, I got to shoot for it. You know, even if I just have this hillbilly tenor voice, it's like, I got to shoot for Ray Charles because it's there. It's like Mount Everest. And why do you climb it? Yeah, because it's there. And it's like, well, you know, I'm dissatisfied with the sound of my voice because I like how Ray Charles sounds. Damn. Why can't I do that?
Yeah. How did you come to terms with that?
Pete Coleman, I call him the lab coat limey, is a British engineer that did Fate's Right Hand and Houston Kid and The Outsider with me. Got me in the studio and he turned off the reverb. I said, hey man, you just turn the reverb off. And he said, yeah, once you learn to sing without reverb, you're going to love it. And he was right. It's like, I discovered the sound of my voice when Pete removed reverb from it. And I would sing to a dry, if I had headphones on, it was dry in the can. And that's when I discovered my voice. Very simple thing like that. Because with a reverb in there, putting that expansion in the sound, I would listen more to the sound of all of that rather than just communicating with the use of my voice. And there I stumbled onto, ah, I like the sound of this voice. It's okay. It ain't Ray Charles, but it's mine and it's pretty good.
Yep.
Yeah, that's when you mentioned people like Ray Charles and Aretha, that's what strikes me about all those legendary voices is how unique they are and how much it is just fully them in that voice. Frank Sinatra or
Don Everly.
Don Everly, Chet Baker, all of that. They're fully there as a person behind their voice. Mm-hmm. They fully own
no
it.
No kidding.
You can feel that.
Mick Jagger.
Yeah.
Bob
but
Dylan.
I think the challenge then is knowing that you're capable of that too. It's not going to sound like Aretha Franklin. The journey of once you fully embrace your voice because it's yours and your way to communicate, that's the intangible why a listener connects to someone's voice, not because it's technically a better singing voice, but because of that kind of intangible, undefinable essence that it's a person sharing their voice. There's so many voices that I love that are technically not great singers, but you can feel that it's them.
Yeah, I think that in my case, I discovered my voice was starting to sound lived in. And that had some gravitas that I had been missing until I was like, oh, yeah, I'm starting to sound lived in. That's good.
Yeah. I've wanted to ask you because I notice kind of a trend of talking to people in creatives who have children, who raise families. A lot of times, we have talked to a lot of men about it, but it kind of trends that women get asked about it, but not a lot of men get asked about what it's like to raise a family and also have a very consuming creative career. You have four children who are all adults now. Can you speak to that a little bit about what that's like to have other beings who you are responsible for while also living this life that takes you away a lot, is very consuming of your energy to create?
Yeah. My oldest daughter, Hannah, her mother and I split when Hannah was, I think, was 16 months old. And I got custody of Hannah. So I was making my first record on Warner Brothers back in 1978. Hannah and I were living in Woodland Hills, the two of us. You know, we were night owls. I hadn't switched over to being a sane human being just because I had a new baby. But I would load up her little portable crib and take it to the studio, and we just lived together, and we lived on Raisin Brands, and, you know, she makes a joke that I would wash the dishes with the same sponge that I wiped her butt with when I changed her diaper. That's her joke. It's probably true. But the thing about it is every mistake that you could make, from driving down on the Hollywood freeway with my two-year-old child standing up beside me with no seatbelt on, and having to slam on the brakes and throwing her into the floorboard and her not miraculously getting hurt. Everything that you could do wrong as a parent, I did it. And that little girl has grown up to be a spectacular woman. Smart, creative, funny, successful. I didn't mess it up. And all of my other three daughters who, you know, raised together with their mother, I didn't mess them up either. And I was selfish and self-absorbed and stoned a lot of time and late getting them to school when I was driving them. I was constantly 5 minutes late getting them to school. And I didn't mess them up. I think if you talk to them, they'd say, well, no, Dad tried, but he didn't mess me up, really. And they would be doing that sarcastically, making a joke. But there's something about it, and this is the most true thing I can say, which is my crowning achievement in the world is being the father of those four women and the grandfather of their children. It's my greatest accomplishment. I'm a patriarch, and all four of my daughters went out into the world, England and San Francisco, and they all went away, New York, and they all came back, and they live close by. And that's the blessing that continues on. I call them she-wolves because they're smart and they're tenacious, and they'll call me on my crap in a minute. And it's right there with Claudia, my wife Claudia. It's like these five women in my life are the ones that bring out the best in me. And they're the ones that inspire me to try to be the best man I can be and to fail sometimes and to succeed sometimes. But at the end of the day, the fact that they're in my life is my single most crowning achievement.
Well, I think that's such a testament, the fact that you have such close relationships with all of your daughters still and in each other's lives. And the way that you spoke about your journey as a father is, again, very generous with your failures and your owning who you are as a person, which I think is wonderful.
Well, I've got a lot of practice being me.
Yeah, maybe that's something that comes with age. And again, like a lot of the motivation, we're in our mid-30s and we have a almost two-year-old daughter, and a lot of our friends are in the same similar age bracket. And we've come to a place of like, okay, we know we're not going to change course. This is the career path that we're in. And we've lived it long enough to see that the way that we approached it in our 20s, we can't sustain it if we continue to approach it in that way, which was sacrifice everything, do everything you can just to have a music career. And so I think we're constantly talking and curious about, how do we sustain a creative career? What does that look like? What is our idea of success? How it's changed from what our kind of narrow view when we first started out? And also, how do we be whole, continually evolving humans? I don't really like the word of saying a good person, because I think we're all good and bad, but being a whole human and really owning that with confidence. And I think creative work feeds that and vice versa. So it's interesting to talk to someone like you who is so open and honest about how it all has interwoven throughout your long career in life.
Yeah. Well, I was thinking while I was listening to you, I was paying attention to what you were saying, but also my own thoughts were bubbling up. It's like, I can't wait till she gets through so I can say what I have to say. It wasn't that. I mean, I was listening to you, but it occurred to me that in answer to what you're talking about, I think what I could share is that despite my flaws, my selfishness, and my outright failures, I think that if you ask my daughters, I think that they would say the one thing that I did succeed in consistently is they know how much I love them. If your child knows how much you love them, truly how much you love them, they'll forgive how stupid you are from time to time. I found that to be the case because God knows I've been a blockhead so many times, but love conquers all.
It does. I think that's a beautiful note to end on.
Okay. There.
We really appreciate you taking time this morning to chat with us and share your experience and your insights.
Thank you. And isn't it interesting how technology can create the opportunity to just have a conversation? We could have been sitting outside having this conversation.
I know, but then we would have had to drive 30, 40 minutes, right? Now we get to just be in our homes. But
yeah. Good luck with this, and it's my pleasure. Thanks for reaching out to me and asking me to take part.
Thank you so much, Rodney, and I hope your tour is great, and I hope you stay healthy and feel good.
Yeah, thank you. Same to you.
We know your time is valuable, and we're grateful you chose to spend this hour with us.
If this conversation resonated with you, know that it is just one of many. We have an archive of over 140 conversations, so if you're looking for where to go to next, you can find curated playlists by topic on our YouTube channel or simply scroll back in this feed to find our conversations with Roseanne Cash, New York Times bestselling author Maggie Smith, Lucius, J.D. McPherson, and many others.
This show is produced by me, Aaron Schaefer-Bates, with help from Michaela Ann. And all the music you hear is written, performed, and produced by me as well.
Our show is edited and mixed by Leland Holden at Podpunch, and we are proud members of the Bluegrass Situation Podcast Network.
Thanks for being here. We'll see you next time.